Good morning. We're delighted to welcome a second group from Brookfield Central High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The Brookfield Central High School students are here today with a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students to come, listen to oral argument, and then participate in a discussion of the procedures of the court after this second oral argument. And they participate in the procedures with a justice assigned for the day to discuss the procedures of the court with the students. Although I say students, everybody is welcome to attend that session. The students have received some materials about this case. They may have engaged in some activities relating to this case. Come for oral argument and will then engage in a discussion with Justice Patrick Crooks. If anyone here would like a summary of the case you're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we'd give you a summary. The marshal will give you a summary. All right. I'm glad everybody is prepared. And let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He's the justice with whom you'll meet at the end of this case. To Justice Crooks's left is Justice Patience Robinson. To her left is Justice Michael Gableman. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Protzer. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call the case of 11-AP-593 Angelia Jamerson versus the Department of Children and Families. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke. Ms. Burke.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke. I'm here today representing the Department of Children and Families, or DCF, and the Division of Hearings and Appeals, or DHA. With me at council table is Randy Keyes, Chief Counsel of DCF. Also in the courtroom today are David Shores, Administrator of DHA, and Administrative Law Judge Ken Duran, who presided over the administrative appeal proceedings in this case. Today, the petitioners asked the court to find the following things. First of all, it's not necessary for DCF to provide an administrative hearing on factual circumstances underlying a welfare fraud conviction that has been legislatively defined as a fraud in order to determine as a matter of law that the conviction is for an offense involving fraudulent activity in the receipt of public benefits requiring revocation of Ms. Jamerson's child care license. It certainly is not necessary when the elements for conviction of that welfare fraud crime include intentional failure to report income or assets. DCF correctly found, as a matter of law, that Ms. Jamerson's conviction for violation of a former statute, 49.126(1), constituted a barring offense under newly created section 48.685(5)(BR)(5), permanently barring licensure as a child care provider. DCF also correctly found, as a matter of law, that the public benefits involved in the commission of that crime were food stamps. In DCF's moving papers, supported by a companion food stamp conviction, evidenced in documents submitted by DCF, not disputed by Ms. Jamerson's administrative proceedings, and in fact never denied by Ms. Jamerson during the lengthy course of this litigation. The correct standard of review for DCF determination that a crime requires revocation of a child care license pursuant to the new permanent barring statute is great weight deference, or certainly no lower than due weight deference. DCF may resolve the administrative appeal of a child care license revocation on a motion to dismiss or on summary judgment when the relevant and uncontroverted facts compel a particular result as a matter of law. Neither the fairness of Ms. Jamerson's administrative proceedings nor the correctness of DCF's revocation decision were impaired in this case by any material error in procedure or failure to follow prescribed procedure.
Let me just interrupt you, if I might, Ms. Burke. Let's see if I understand the state's position. As I understand the case and the state's position, it is that the state must show one, fraudulent activity under the statute, and two, that a particular statute was violated. So if there's fraud as to ABC, but it's not one of the listed offenses under the new statute, doesn't matter. So you got a two-part proof,
yes,
with the burden on the state. If I understand the case, the idea that Ms. Jamerson's sister was dealing in illicit drugs near the facility, that's no longer a ground for revocation. Is that right?
Yeah.
So
yes,
we don't have to worry about that in this case.
Right.
Might have been, but not. Okay. And secondly, my question is, you've got, and I'll see if I can remember all these statutes. You've got in the case two underlying statutes, right? One is 49-127-2M, right? And the reference is made to that, I think, in the Court of Appeals. But my understanding is that at the administrative law judge level, as adopted by the department, what is at issue is 49.12.1, sub 1, sub 6.
Yes, Your Honor. The basis for the revocation upon which the motion to dismiss was premised was that conviction of 49.12 sub 6.
Okay. So, and that's now 49.95 and is a public assistance program, if I understand all this. So the court focus should be, under the state's position, whether the state adequately proved violation of 49.12.16 by Ms. Jamerson in the 1990s, right, was one, a fraudulent activity, and two, was a particular statute covered?
A particular type of public
I'm sorry, that's a better way of saying a particular type of conduct, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So what did the state prove?
Well, the state proved that Ms. Jamerson had been convicted of the Section 49.12 conviction.
And they did it how?
Well, Ms. Jamerson herself had admitted those convictions earlier on before she acquired counsel. She had admitted them back in March of 2009 in her background information disclosure in one of her pro se pleadings. She also had admitted them. So all of this
admitted a conviction under this statute.
She admitted her 1991 convictions. Then in the notice of revocation that was issued by the department, the convictions were specified, both by number, and I believe that there was a summary description of each. Then in the motion to dismiss, the department alleged the 49.12 conviction as the basis for revocation, attached a copy of the background information disclosure, attached a criminal background check report, which it had obtained from the Department of Justice showing those convictions, as well as the other food stamp conviction, and asserted that based on those, as a matter of law, the administrative law judge should uphold the revocation. I'll just note before we go too much further that the first conviction you mentioned, the one for food stamp fraud, although it's not the foundational conviction upon which DCF relies for the revocation, it does have some evidentiary value in documenting that the particular public benefits involved in the other conviction were food stamps.
So you have to rely on the other conviction to show a food stamp violation?
Well, it's part of the administrative record that documents receipt of food stamps. The offenses were charged contemporaneously. They were resolved on the same date.
So that's where you're getting the food stamp.
Yes, and Ms. Jamerson has never denied receipt of food stamps. She has never suggested in any of her filings that any other public benefits were involved. And so with that information before him, the administrative law judge was entitled to draw the inference based on the uncontroverted information in the record that food stamps were the public benefit involved in Ms. Jamerson's welfare fraud conviction.
But you need to show a food stamp violation here.
Yes, although in Chapter 227 proceedings, the burden of persuasion is on Ms. Jamerson, and she has not controverted the state's position at all.
You don't have the burden of persuasion for revoking?
Excuse me?
You don't have the burden of persuasion to revoke?
The burden of persuasion in a Chapter 227 proceeding is on the petitioner to demonstrate that the agency's position is incorrect. The agency's decision is presumed to be correct.
Okay, that's here, but at the agency level, before the judge, who has the burden of persuasion?
In the administrative proceeding, it is the party challenging the agency's decision.
Oh, so you think the burden is always on Ms. Jamerson?
The burden is on her in that proceeding to show that the agency's decision was incorrect. So then when we get to judicial review, that's when different standards of review apply. There, depending on whether it's a question of fact or a question of law, and the appropriate standard here, the question of fact is a little bit different than the usual substantial evidence standard because there was not a hearing, and the question of law has been an issue. The standard for the question of law has been an issue in these proceedings since the circuit court.
The fraudulent activity, where do you get an appropriate finding on fraud? Is it because sub 6 says it should be deemed fraud?
That should be sufficient. The legislature has defined that activity as constituting a fraud. Could not be clearer. And fraudulent activity, as used in the licensure prohibition statute, fraudulent, in the dictionary, plain meaning, means accomplished by fraud. But secondarily, the jury instructions for that particular offense, 49.126, since 1980, well before Ms. Jamerson's conviction, have identified an element of intent not to report, and that then also reiterates that this is a conviction involving fraudulent activity. In fact, in the case where this court looked at that statute on a duplicity issue, the Schumacher case, the court actually characterized the type of overgrant that was paid in that case as a fraudulent overgrant. And so there's the language of the statute itself, there's the jury instructions, there's the common understanding of that statute as evidenced by this own court's jurisprudence.
Could I ask you some questions here? Suppose Ms. Jamerson had been convicted of only a violation of 49.12, 1 and 6. And that was presented to the administrative law judge.
That would be sufficient, Your Honor, to prove a permanently barring conviction. Because of the way the statute is constructed by the legislature, defining that activity as a fraud, the jury instruction, the court's prior language, there have been a number of other cases, and I've included the circuit court decisions for many of them in the separate appendix to petitioner's brief. And so some of them involve a conviction for a statute that's characterized as 49.1261 or 49.1216. But there are also other convictions where only one of those statutes is identified. For example, the key case involved only 49.126, the statute that you're asking about. There's another case, the Ragsdale case, that involved 49.121.
Okay. Well, let me ask this. If there's a conviction under 49.12.16, how does a fact finder know what benefits are involved?
That information could come from a number of sources. Here we happen to know because of the companion food stamp benefits conviction that occurred at the same time that there's...
But the administrative law judge didn't rely on that.
He didn't rely on that as the predicate conviction for application of the permanent barring statute, but he did mention that it had been asserted in the motion to dismiss and drew the conclusion, although it wasn't articulated in detail, that food stamp benefits were the benefits involved in the 49.12 conviction. So that other conviction, the food stamp conviction, actually has more of an evidentiary value in this case, but it might also be proven in other ways by proffering a criminal complaint, outlining the underlying facts.
Was that done here?
The criminal complaint was not provided with the motion to dismiss.
So there really wasn't any evidence provided through testimony or really documents. It was simply a reliance on the two convictions as shown in the judgment.
The judgment of conviction was pre-filed as an exhibit to the hearing, which had been scheduled but then did not occur when the administrative law judge granted the motion to dismiss. What had been filed with the motion to dismiss was the Crime Information Bureau report and the background disclosure form that Ms. Jamerson had filled out.
Would it be fair to say that a conviction under 49.12 in 1991 wouldn't necessarily apply to one of the benefits outlined in 48.685.5BR5?
Yes. There might have been other kind of benefits not included in the list in that statute. Energy assistance benefits, general relief, those are not specified. And why this case is different, we know by the second conviction that food stamps were involved here. If we didn't have the second conviction from which the ALJ could have drawn that food stamps inference, and we didn't have anything else, no complaint, no affidavit, no anything, then we would have insufficient information to conclude that one of the specified benefits was involved. But here, we have more. Because we know about the other conviction, because we know that Ms. Jamerson had affirmed that she had those 1991 convictions, and because they showed up on the background information disclosure form that had been provided to the administrative law judge. In other cases, we might not have that information, and then we would need more. We would need a complaint. We would need an affidavit. We would need potentially testimony from someone in a hearing setting, but we didn't need that here.
It seems to me if the dates listed for the offenses were identical, you'd have a pretty good argument. If the complaint was on the record, I think you might have a good argument. But the dates aren't, they don't mesh. They're different from each other. And so the linkage, this inference that you're drawing, it seems to me is a little bit shaky considering the gravity of the effect on Ms. Jamerson.
What we do know, Justice Prosser, from the judgment of conviction that was filed is that the time frame for the 49.12 offense was longer than and completely encompassed the time frame for the food stamps offense. And so food stamps were being received during the time frame for which Ms. Jamerson has been convicted of the welfare fraud offense. The ALJ drew an inference that should be sufficient on this record, absent any other evidence of any other public benefit. There is no conflicting evidence. There's never been a denial that Ms. Jamerson was receiving food stamps. All she would have had to do once the motion to dismiss was filed was respond with 10 words or less. I deny that I received food stamps. She was put on notice by the motion to dismiss, by the notice of revocation, that was the basis upon which DCF was proceeding, that she had been convicted of an offense involving food stamps.
If this was such a simple case, why is it that the ALJ didn't go on the two grounds? The circuit court rejected the ground that the ALJ relied on. The Court of Appeals was troubled by the whole procedure. I mean, considering the gravity of the effect of the law on this particular party, why wasn't the thing tightened up and proven in a more orderly fashion?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I can't answer why another lawyer proceeded as she did in this particular case. But the fact of the matter is, Ms. Jamerson has been represented by counsel for years now, since before the administrative hearing. And her counsel has never said she didn't receive food stamps. There's been no challenge to that, other than to say, DCF, you have to prove it. But absent any conflicting evidence, the ALJ is allowed to draw the inference from the existence of that food stamps conviction. Why DCF didn't base its revocation directly on the food stamps conviction, I also don't know, but it's clear that the welfare fraud conviction involved activity that so clearly had been identified by the legislature as a fraud. And, you know, these are meant to be proceedings that afford the opportunities, a fair opportunity to present their cases for further consideration. That's what DCF did here. It had a clear winner. And so that's how the agency proceeded.
Do you know if the convictions for failure to report income and for the food stamp fraud were the result of a trial, or whether it was a default or a plea? Do you know?
Justice Rogensack, the judgment of conviction indicates that they resulted from a guilty plea.
A guilty plea.
So under applicable law, the fact of that guilty plea can be used in subsequent civil proceedings as proof of all elements of that offense.
Thank you.
Was there anything to indicate what the almost $7,200 in restitution was for?
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor.
Is the plea colloquy in that original offense in the early 90s part of the record here?
No, Your Honor, it's not. And that conviction was not appealed, so I think it was unlikely that the transcript would have been prepared.
But it's somewhere in the bowels of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court.
Perhaps.
Or maybe it's already been destroyed, depending on what the retention provision is for a felony. But that, if there was such a transcript or a record, that would give us what the factual basis was, theoretically, if it was done properly by Judge Geske.
Well, and that brings us right to the crux of the matter here. DCF should not be forced in a proceeding like this where the revocation is predicated on the fact of a conviction identified as a fraud, to have to go back 5, 10 or more years and reprove those same predicate facts all over again. Now, perhaps there would be another conviction identified as a predicate offense that would not have the same clear qualification as the 49.12 offense here, you know, some kind of misconduct in office, you know, some other kind of offense, that it would not be clear from the offense itself, from its elements, that fraudulent activity in the receipt of public benefits is involved. Then, yes, it would be appropriate to require DCF to go back and prove up the background. But that's not true here, and that would be so burdensome on the system. And in some cases, where, as you've pointed out, records might no longer exist, relevant persons might no longer be available, that would so completely disrupt what the legislature is trying to do here, to impose that unnecessary burden on the DCF and DHA.
There's a slight burden on Ms. Jameson, too, namely permanent revocation, right?
Ms. Jameson has been represented by counsel throughout, Your Honor, and as I said before, all Ms. Jameson had to do to force a hearing would have been to raise a factual dispute about a relevant matter.
So you think that state has made a prima facie case, produced evidence, and the burden of going forward with contrary evidence shifted to Ms. Jameson. Even the burden of persuasion may have stayed with the state at the original ALJ.
The burden of identifying any material factual dispute went to Ms. Jameson. Mm-hmm. Because without that, the ALJ properly decided the matter as a question of law. There was no contrary evidence.
You disagree with the Court of Appeals as to due weight. You would give great weight, if I understand it. If I understand your argument, you don't disagree, that is, you do agree with the Court of Appeals, that the state had two factors, one, fraudulent activity, and two, a predicate offense. That was your obligation. You agree with that?
If I could just clarify one thing, Your Honor. In this case, the Court of Appeals found that de novo was the appropriate
standard. I understand
standard.
That. Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, in the Brown case, found that due weight was appropriate. And yes, it's the petitioner's position that it should be at least due weight. No court other than the Court of Appeals in this case who's looked at these cases has recognized any level other than that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Burke. Ms. Kastner of Legal Action of Wisconsin, representing Angelia Jamerson.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jill Kastner of Legal Action of Wisconsin, representing petitioner appellant Angelia Jamerson. With me today is Sheila Sullivan, also of Legal Action. Ms. Jamerson was a successful business owner operating a large group child care center when DCF revoked her license, shut down her business, and put her employees out of work. After Ms. Jamerson timely appealed this state action, DCF dismissed her appeal, denying her a hearing based on nothing more than unsworn documents and unsupported assumptions concerning Ms. Jamerson's sole criminal conviction from 2 decades earlier. Now, here we are today, more than 2 years later, and still Ms. Jamerson has not had a meaningful opportunity to challenge the state revocation of her license and the shutting down of her business. This morning I'd like to address 3 issues. First, the standard of review and the level of deference appropriate when dealing with a novel procedure used by DCF and a novel issue of law presented by the statutory construction. The second issue deals with the procedure that DCF used in summarily dismissing an appeal on the merits, yet without a hearing. And third, the new caregiver law itself. What is an offense involving fraudulent activity, and what is DCF's burden in proving that the very severe lifetime bar should be imposed on a child care provider? Now, as to the level of deference in regards to the procedure, the Court of Appeal correctly concluded that this is a matter of first impression. Ms. Jamerson was the very first case in which the new child care statute was imposed to revoke the license of a child care provider. There was no earlier case. All of the other cases were decided after this one. Therefore, as to the legal interpretation and DCF statutory construction of the new caregiver law and its new and unique provision for a fraudulent activity category of offenses is entitled to de novo review. As to the procedure, DCF...
Before you go to the second point, when did the child care business stop operating?
The child care business stopped operating in December of 2009. As Chief Justice Abrahamson pointed out, there were the 2 separate reasons for revocation. One, dealing with a very unfortunate incident with one of Ms. Jamerson's employees, and the other one dealing with the legal issue we're here today for.
Would it be fair to say that she received... after a suspension notice, a revocation notice on January 20th, 2010?
Correct, which of course was a few weeks before the new caregiver law took effect on February the 1st.
Have you made a point of the fact that they're enforcing a law before it took effect?
That was one of the arguments that was intended to be made at the hearing, which unfortunately we never had.
But this statute is retroactive in the sense that any prior offense, whenever it occurred, would affect your license today. So even if they brought it early, they just say, hey, it's harmless error because they could bring it 10 days later, statute would be in effect.
Yes, so it doesn't matter whether the conviction was 20, 30 or more years old, it would still create a permanent bar to licensure under DCF's interpretation.
So if it took effect February 1, they just put her out of business 10 days early, 11 days early. They could have done February 1, put her out of business, if they did it right.
Essentially, and of course, because of the administrative review process, although she was shut down in December, she wasn't going to get her revocation hearing until that early June date, just because of the process going through. And in fact, this motion to dismiss was brought only a few weeks before the scheduled hearing and was responded to as a motion to dismiss.
There was no stay of the revocation.
No. There, she was suspended and was and continues because of the revocation. So unfortunately, for all of her client, the children have all found other providers. Her employees have all found other jobs to work at.
Has there ever been a denial that one of her convictions resulted from food stamps?
Absolutely.
Were
Ms. Jamerson to be given a hearing, she would present evidence such as the criminal complaint to prove that her 4912 conviction did not involve food stamps.
Why wasn't something filed in response to the motion to dismiss then, an affidavit attaching the complaint saying that that's not what this conviction resulted from?
Well, DCF would have this court believe that the motion to dismiss was in fact a motion for summary judgment. It was not. In order to invoke the right for a 227 hearing, a petitioner, a license holder, has one obligation, timely appeal. Ms. Jamerson complied with that obligation. She timely appealed the revocation. She found counsel. She participated in the pre-hearing conference, exchanged, you know, witness lists and exhibits, and was ready to go to her hearing when DCF filed a motion to dismiss based on a failure to state a claim. However, it's not the petitioner who has the burden of proof. It is the agency, DCF, which bears the burden of proof on revocation. DCF bears the burden of moving forward with their evidence and to present their evidence that revocation is appropriate. Therefore, on a motion to dismiss, Ms. Jamerson had complied with her obligations by timely appealing, and she did respond by noting that that was her only obligation, and in this particular case, there are factual issues in dispute, the biggest one being, was she convicted of an offense involving fraudulent activity?
Well, I don't think relying on whether it was fraudulent activity, that's a different question than I asked you. The statute says that if she is convicted under 4912 sub 6, it's fraud. And I don't think you're asking us to say what the legislature said is fraud is something other than that, are you?
I would absolutely argue that a 4912 sub 6 conviction is not, in all cases, an offense involving fraudulent activity.
Okay, well, that's a different question, and my interest was whether she ever denied that her conviction, her two convictions, actually, one of them, was involving food stamps. Has she ever denied the food stamp part? That's what I'm interested in.
Absolutely, she denies it and would intend at a trial to present evidence, including the judgment of the criminal complaint.
Where would I find that in the record if I wanted to go and look and see, here she said I wasn't convicted of a food stamp violation. Where would I find food stamps, those words in the record from her?
You wouldn't, because Ms. Jamerson was, DCF did not bring a summary judgment motion.
Okay.
DCF brought a motion to dismiss on failure to state a claim.
If you look at the Rules of Civil Procedure, with which I'm sure you're very well aware, mm-hmm. when someone files a motion to dismiss and they submit other supporting documentation outside of the basic allegation, then it can be treated as a motion for summary judgment. But I think we're dancing on the head of a pin. The question is, has she ever denied it on this record?
No, and it's not her burden to make the denial.
Well, that's a separate argument, and you may be right, but I just want to know if it's in the record. That's all.
So if I understand you correctly, once she says, I want an appeal, she gets a hearing, and there's no way around that.
Well, there are certainly summary judgment proceedings. Under Administrative Code HA 110 sub 2, a party can request summary judgment, the ALJ can grant it, and then they can proceed with summary judgment under the provisions of 80208. That wasn't done in this case because DCF never complied with the summary judgment requirements of coming forward with affidavits or sworn documents. All it did in this case was have basically a 4.5-page motion to dismiss, stapling together four documents, the most relevant of which is the CIB, which on its face is erroneous or at the very best ambiguous because it identifies a statute number that never existed. So we're here today with DCF having not made a prima facie case, having submitted only unsworn documents, no affidavit. There's no substantive evidence in the record that clearly and unambiguously says what Ms. Jamerson was convicted of and whether or not that conviction involved food food stamps.
Could you substantiate what you just said, that the document submitted cited the wrong statute?
The CIB, which is attached to the motion to dismiss, identifies the conviction as one under 4912, sub 1, sub 6. No comma, no and. It simply says sub 1, sub 6. The judgment of conviction, of course, says 4912, sub 6, sub and sub 1. The two documents differing. And then, of course, for the second count for the food stamp violation, it goes through the full string of numbers without a comma or an and, making it ambiguous as to what was meant by that document.
Counsel, let me ask you what was filed pre-hearing. It's my understanding that from what we heard from Ms. Burke, that the judgment of conviction, among other things, was filed pre-hearing. Is there any authority that says that the ALJ cannot consider what has been filed in that regard?
Well, this was merely the exhibit list. This was not offered into evidence at any hearing because, of course, no hearing was held. Therefore, there was no opportunity from which Ms. Jamerson could make any objections to any of the documents. Therefore, concluding that it's somehow part of the record, even though Ms. Jamerson had no opportunity to contest the documents, I think would be very troubling.
Do the rules of evidence strictly apply in regard to an administrative hearing of this nature?
Well, there are the relaxed rules, particularly in regards to the hearing. Now, in terms of the 227 proceeding for summary judgment, there it is clear that the rules of 80208 apply. However, for the hearing itself, it would allow relaxed rules of evidence. But again, there was no hearing.
Now, the relief you're asking for here, as I understand it, is a hearing, period. Is that right?
Yes. That is exactly right. And as is shown in the cases which DCF has cited, that doesn't mean necessarily a full-blown evidentiary hearing. DCF does have the option of seeking summary judgment. If they believe that they can prevail on that particular issue, they can seek summary judgment, the ALJ can agree it's appropriate, and they can go forward with affidavits and sworn documents and evidence proving each of the elements of their case, and then the burden would shift to Ms. Jamerson to rebut that evidence and to present her own evidence, which she would intend to prove, showing that she has never been convicted of an offense involving fraudulent activity and that her 4912 offense has nothing to do with food stamps.
Is the complaint for case number that is listed on the judgment of conviction, is that complaint on CCAP?
The
complaint that started all this out before we got a judgment of conviction, there's a court case number, and I guess my question to you is the complaint on CCAP? Do you know?
It's among the court records. I have a copy of the criminal complaint, yes.
You may, but I can certainly easily find it on CCAP, and if it isn't in the record, which is what I understood you to say before, I thought, well, maybe that's
it's not in the administrative record on appeal. It's certainly in the Milwaukee County Court records.
Well, right, that we can locate on CCAP.
You can locate the
the document.
Record,
that's all I'm asking you if you know. And if you don't know, that's fine, too.
The full documents don't appear on CCAP.
Not in any access to CCAP that I can get, no.
Okay. All right. So you don't think the complaint would be there, then?
Again, it would be in the Milwaukee County Court records. I don't think there's an electronic version available
online.
Okay,
that's all I wanted to know. Thank you very much.
Now, the Court of Appeals concluded that there were issues of material fact and that your client is entitled to an administrative hearing. You say that comes the hearing, it can be determined on summary judgment.
DCF can certainly move for summary judgment, and if they believe that they have sufficient evidence to establish a prima facie case, that would be their ability to do that, and Ms. Jamerson would then have the burden, once a prima facie case is made, of going forward with her own evidence.
And you don't think that would be contrary to the Court of Appeals holding?
Not at all. I think the Court of Appeals conclusion was that it needed to be remanded to the administrative level for proper administrative procedures to be had. And if that includes a motion for summary judgment, which, and to be clear, Ms. Jamerson firmly believes that DCF cannot prevail on a motion for summary judgment. To the contrary, Ms. Jamerson believes that DCF would not be able to prevail on a motion for summary judgment, but it would certainly be within DCF's power to seek to do so.
And as I read the Court of Appeals decision, the material, the issue of material fact is whether the 49.12, 1 and 6 violation was a fraud involving food stamps.
Well, I think the Court of Appeals, as it should, decided this case on the narrowest grounds possible, and that narrowest grounds being the easiest, does it involve food stamps? Because there's zero evidence in the record on this fact. Were it to be remanded, there would be obviously additional evidence and arguments that could be raised at that time.
Well, the reason they thought there was zero evidence on this record was because they were not willing to make the inference that the state wants to make from the 49-127-2M conviction. And then they said, given that the offenses occurred during different times, this is paragraph 23, it is quite possible that the latter scenario is, in effect, what occurred here, namely that the charge was under 127-2M.
Correct. And an inference would be improper when dealing with a dismissal based on a motion to dismiss or on a grant of summary judgment.
Well, you know, the state argues, and not without merit, that here you have a license for child care, right? Important function.
Very important.
Protect our children, right?
Absolutely.
And the legislature has taken the position that this is so important to protect children that if you've been convicted of a fraud, at least certain areas, that really disqualifies you. Because once convicted of a fraud in these areas, you're going to do it again. I mean, that's what the legislature is afraid of. Right?
I would disagree with the legislature, but that
they
certainly
disagree
was
with
what
them,
was in their
but,
thinking.
But that's what the law is, and unless you find that law invalid, which you're not arguing.
Not today.
No, not today, right. That's what I thought. If you found that law valid today, then you've got this old conviction. It's, 18 years old, roughly. 1990, 91?
A little
whatever.
Over 20.
Close to 20, okay. Pleaded guilty, so probably not transcribed. Don't even know if the records exist.
Right.
Right? Although you got the complaint, so you found it somewhere. So some records exist, whether in her possession or elsewhere. And you're going to ask the state to prove that it's a violation of food stamp, and all these statutes have been renumbered along the way, right?
Many, yes.
Yeah. Isn't that too heavy a burden for the state? Why can't they just show, hey, look, there's a conviction here. There's a conviction of fraudulent activity because it's defined that way in the statute. Got something to do with welfare, something to do with getting some benefit from the state, maybe. Looks that way. You got this food stamp. It's overlapping. Doesn't cover it perfectly, but it's overlapping. Why hasn't the state proven enough, gone forward with the burden of proof, have gone forward with the production of evidence, and now it's in your camp, and you didn't make the basic argument of we deny.
Well, Ms. Jamerson did make the argument that a motion to dismiss was inappropriate because there were basic factual issues in dispute, namely, does she have a conviction under the new fraudulent activity category? But more importantly, and specific to this case, they haven't proven anything regarding what public assistance program was violated, and there are several public assistance programs that are not covered.
Like
local public assistance programs, rent assistance style programs, those the legislators did not include among the bar. Now, what DCF has argued is two extremes. On one extreme, they're saying that if you have to allow this case, otherwise we're going to have to try to reprove all of the elements of the original criminal offense. Or, on the other hand, we should be able to use proof of a conviction alone as some type of irrebuttable presumption from which a petitioner is not allowed to even submit any evidence to the contrary to show that their particular offense did not involve fraudulent activity. And whenever given the choices of two extremes, the correct answer is none of the above. There is a very reasonable middle ground here, and that is there's a big difference between what the state can use to prove and meet their burden of proof and what they would need in order to prevent a petitioner from having a hearing, to prevent a petitioner from utilizing either the summary judgment procedures or the hearing procedures in order to present their case and arguments. In this particular case, DCF isn't saying that proof of a 4912 sub 6 sub 1 conviction should be enough that we win, but rather that it's preclusive to allowing the introduction of evidence to the contrary, and that's the case that we're faced with here. Though I would certainly argue that, particularly in the case of 4912 sub 6, as the trial court judge, Judge Maloney, concluded, sometimes those were strict liability offenses. There's a difference between what the legislator may have considered a fraud for penalty purposes and what is an offense involving fraudulent activity. Surely the legislature was not creating a lifetime bar to ever holding a child care license or certification for somebody who was convicted 20 years ago of a strict liability offense. Ms. Jamerson and other child care providers is entitled to an opportunity to present evidence and arguments to prove that her offense did not even involve an allegation of a false misrepresentation, that her offense did not involve any intent to deceive, that her delay in reporting receipt and extra income had far more to do with the fact that her husband was dying of an illness than it did with any wrongful conduct. This is the evidence Ms. Jamerson should have her hearing, or at least some type of summary judgment procedure, so that she can present her evidence and arguments showing that she has never been convicted of an offense that is barred under this new fraudulent activity.
Counselor, if you were allowed to prove all of those things and you look at the jury instructions for the offenses of which she was convicted, should there have been a trial, she never could have been convicted because they specifically require a jury to find intent. Now, I know that this resulted from a plea, but unless the plea colloquy was bad, and we're not going there on a collateral attack of the judgment, I really don't see how you can prove in one proceeding things that are necessary to a conviction in another proceeding without at the same time attacking that judgment. That's why I have a problem with your argument.
Unfortunately, a jury instruction is not law.
Of course it's not law, but the jury still has elements that it has to find, okay, under the statute for a conviction. And I understand, of course, that a jury instruction is not law. But she never would have been convicted by a jury under the instructions we use all the time, if what you're saying is true.
As we can see with the Schumacher case, and as Judge Maloney found in his own findings, sometimes 4912 sub 6 convictions were deemed strict liability offenses where the only thing that the state needed to prove was she on public assistance? D, did she receive income, and did she continue to receive benefits and not report the income within the 10-day requirement? That's a strict liability offense. And based on the elements of the language of the statute itself, and in fact even the jury instructions recognize that it was being treated as a strict liability offense.
Now, the jury instructions, I mean, I just got them out and looked at them, and it says you have to prove she intended. Okay, and knew she wasn't entitled, but intended. I mean, I'm sure you probably looked at them as well. But it's really troublesome because what you're essentially trying to do is collaterally attack a conviction, because if what you think you can prove in this hearing is as you're representing to us, then certainly she can't have been guilty of what she was convicted of. Okay, the fourth element relates to failure to report the receipt of income, and it must have been intentional. I mean, I'm just reading from the jury instructions.
But the jury instructions were created because it was being treated as a strict liability offense. And as the Schumacher and other cases
strict show, liability doesn't require intent. Intent is a state of mind, right?
Correct. And the statute itself doesn't talk of intent. And particularly when you're dealing with a plea bargain agreement where someone is being faced with the option of either I have a trial on this felony count or I simply get probation, I pay back the money, they say I was overpaid, and I can still continue to receive my public benefits and I don't have any time taken away from my children, they're not looking at what might be argued were this to go to a jury trial. And unfortunately, at the time of Ms. Jamerson's conviction, they weren't looking at all of those things. The jury instructions was simply not the law, and the state was still arguing that all they needed to prove was that you were on benefits, you received income, and you didn't report it within the time period. And those were the elements that they were looking for.
So what's your attack? Was this a benefit that's listed as a predicate offense?
I would have to go to evidence outside the record, but
I want you to do that, but that's one of the possibilities, I assume.
It is absolutely one of the possibilities that the state will not be able to prove that it was one of the listed public assistance.
And that would not be attacking collaterally this conviction.
Correct.
Conviction would be just fine, theoretically.
Correct.
But it would be attacking the possibility of using this conviction because it is not a predicate offense.
Correct.
So you may or may not be barred, ultimately, if you do win, of what kind of evidence you might be able to present at the hearing. Administrative law judge might say to you, hey, we're not going to collaterally attack. Or the administrative law judge says no holds barred. I don't know.
Well, certainly DCF must meet their prima facie case of establishing each element, and should they fail to do that, including failing to prove that it was one of the listed public benefits programs, then DCF cannot prevail. They cannot meet their burden.
You view it as their burden. Mm-hmm. You view it as the state's burden.
It is absolutely the state's burden on a 227 appeal on revocation to prove the grounds for revocation.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals makes reference to prior to the enactment of the new law that there existed a permanent but rebuttable presumption of disqualification from licensure, and also the opportunity to show that there had been some rehabilitation because there's no longer a threat posed to children. How does that reference by the Court of Appeals affect this case, given that the revocation was implemented prior to the effective date of the new legislation? How does that all come together?
Well, it's one of those constitutional arguments and irrebuttable arguments that Ms. Jamerson did not have the opportunity to present or to create a full record for which this court could then review the decision. And yet another reason why it's so important to have the hearing or the summary judgment procedures as authorized under 227 so that a full and complete record can be created on appeal from which this court can review those types of decisions.
What's the effective date, or is there an effective provision in this new law? Does it say it affects all cases pending? Does it affect?
It affects all license holders as of February 1 of 2010. So, again, it doesn't matter how old the conviction is, going back or going forward. It creates a permanent, irrebuttable bar to not only holding a child care license, but from even working in regulated child care, so working for any licensed or certified child care provider.
The specific authority that addresses the burden for whichever party in terms of a license revocation is, there seems to be a difference of opinion of who is right, who has the burden, and your authority is?
Chapter 227, that would be the required, DCF is the state agency, has the burden of proof on a revocation of a child care license. And the provider is entitled to a contested case hearing so long as they timely make their appeal, which was done in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Burke?
The burden of persuasion is on the person challenging the administrative decision. That's the Sterling-Worth case after the state establishes its prima facie case. Ms. Jamerson did have more responsibility in the administrative proceedings than just asking for a hearing. The Omernick case makes it very clear that she had the obligation of raising issues she wished to litigate with sufficient prominence for the administrative law judge to understand them, recognize them, and make the appropriate record. The petitioner's brief lays out in detail what Ms. Jamerson said at various junctures in the administrative proceedings about the specific factual issues she wanted the administrative law judge to consider. There was one, and it was not the public benefits involved, and it was not the 49.12 conviction of which she stands convicted. It was to make DCF reprove that she had been engaging in some fraudulent activity pertaining to the receipt of public benefits. That's it. That's all she ever specified. As I indicated earlier, she had said more. The administrative law judge would have put on notice that she wanted to make a record so that she could litigate constitutional issues later on, that she wanted to raise the issue of which public benefits she had been receiving.
Counselor, earlier on, I thought you said that she had admitted a food stamp involved violation in one of her responses, but I may not have written that correct. Was that correct or not?
Your Honor, in her background information disclosure form, it was more general. She admitted her 1991 convictions, of which one was the food stamp.
Okay, but she didn't say she admitted a food stamp violation.
Correct.
Okay, thank you very much.
So it's just not true that Ms. Jamerson can now come and say for the first time in this court, well, I wanted to prove this, and these were the facts. Her obligation to raise those issues was years ago in the administrative proceedings. Someone asked about the effective date of the revocation. The revocation notice indicated that it would be February 1st, 2010, the effective date of the new barring legislation, and that can be found at document 3, page 6 in the appellate record. As to whether or not that 49.126 offense was a strict liability offense, it's been clear since the 1977 Kolova case that it was not strict liability, that intent was required. As to the value of the jury instructions, as this court has said many times, they're prepared by a very distinguished group of judges, practitioners, and legal scholars, and the court has very consistently recognized their value and their worth. So to say that maybe Ms. Jamerson was convicted of a strict liability offense just as contrary to the state of the law. The administrative law judge here went out of his way to bend over backward to make sure that Ms. Jamerson had a case to raise any relevant issues when the motion to dismiss was filed. When he found the motion to dismiss that morning, I think it was before 9 o'clock, he immediately directed DCF's attorney to provide it right away to Ms. Jamerson's counsel, and then followed up with the attorney to make sure that had been done. Those communications are in the record. Ms. Jamerson, in fact, did attach a document to her response to the motion to dismiss. There's no reason that she could not have attached other documents, affidavits, the judgment of conviction. She chose not to. So to the extent that this pleading filed by DCF was captioned motion to dismiss, maybe it should have been captioned motion for summary judgment because there were some attachments. Nothing prevented Ms. Jamerson from providing her own attachments to show the administrative judge why a hearing was necessary or to establish that there really was some actual conflict of material fact. But she chose not to do that. She put all her eggs in one basket, and that was DCF has to prove the factual circumstances of the fraudulent activity that had occurred previously. As for DCF arguing two extremes, thank you. I see my light is on.
Complete your argument well enough, counsel. Thank you. I want to thank Ms. Kastner and Ms. Burke for their arguments and for their briefs on a new issue to come to the court regarding the new statute. And that concludes our hearing, 11AP 593, Angelia Jamerson versus Department of Children and Families. The students may, if their time permits, remain in the courtroom, and anyone else who wishes to do so may remain, and Justice Brooks will be out shortly. We are in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case.